May it please the court, my name is Jeffrey Leon, and I am one of the attorneys for the plaintiffs, the victims of the Hungarian Holocaust. I will be addressing today issues related to this court's appellate jurisdiction, as well as the substantive issues concerning personal jurisdiction defenses raised by defendant OTP Bank and MKB Bank. If there's a single overriding theme to plaintiff's position on this appeal, it is a call to restore orderliness to a litigation process that has been thoroughly disrupted by an extraordinary rush to the appellate court, where in over 400 pages of briefing to the district court, every single issue raised to the district court has been urged by one or more of the defendants to be so significant as requiring the interlocutory intervention of this court, save for one issue, one lonely issue, forum nonconvenience, is an issue that was presented to the district court and is the only issue of more than a dozen that have not been urged upon this court to intervene on an interlocutory basis. We respectfully submit that this would be the most significant intervention by an appellate court in a district court decision that we've seen on all of these issues.
With respect to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, are there any cases, would you agree that the district court actually denied the motion to dismiss?
No, Your Honor, I would not agree. And
did I misread what Judge Yerdrigian said when he said the motion is denied?
Yes. I believe that you did, and I read what they said. And what I wanted to do, it was apparent to me that Judge Yerdrigian had read Karami. And so what I did, I put on a piece of paper for my own self what Judge Yerdrigian said with regard to his FSIA decision and looked at it side by side with what the district court in Karami said. By the way, in similarly summary fashion, in a single paragraph, the district court in Karami, which this court found not to be a final order, said, defendants argue I should dismiss plaintiff's claim based on qualified immunity. I find these attacks on plaintiff's complaint are premature. And then he cited two cases, Alvarado versus Litcher and Jacobs versus City of Chicago, where Judge Easterbrook is quoted as stating that Rule 12b-6 is a mismatch for immunity and almost always a bad ground for dismissal. Then I looked at what Judge Yerdrigian said. Now we're almost approaching a metaphysical question of, you know, what when a judge says his decision isn't final, when does he really mean what he says? This is a quote from Judge Yerdrigian. It is premature at this juncture to adjudicate Magyar's denial of the facts alleged. At the summary judgment stage of the proceedings, if warranted, Magyar may re-raise the arguments that it did not own or operate the property at issue, or that it did not engage in commercial activity within the meaning of the FSIA.
The Supreme Court has said that a denial of a 12b-6 qualified immunity is immediately appealable, even if you can later bring a summary judgment motion asserting qualified immunity as well. Under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, have any federal appellate courts rejected appellate jurisdiction in a case such as this?
Your Honor, the answer is no, except with a qualifier, in a case such as this. There has been no FSIA case where the district court has...
Has there been any FSIA case in which the federal circuit courts have said a denial of immunity was not appealable?
On a final order, on an order that they found to be final,
denied.
The answer is no.
Motion denied.
The motion was denied because he did not grant it. But again, you can focus, as the defendants have,
why
on those
don't you
two
move
words.
On to some other subjects?
Okay.
Yeah, because I just still want to get an answer, and the answer is no, though. Because our circuit is made clear, and the other circuits have made clear, that sovereign immunity is immediately appealable under the collateral order doctrine, right?
A final order.
Right.
And that's where... You know, that's where our dispute is with the plaintiffs, Your Honor, is simply what does final mean.
Can you give us any cases that that agree with your characterization in terms of final, what we're quibbling about here, right?
Well, the Karami case. I believe the Karami case where the judge did not rule He said it's premature. That's what Judge Duryagin said. It's
okay.
premature.
Well, I have a fundamental disagreement with you on that, but I agree. Move on.
Okay. The next basis for appellate jurisdiction that we've been presented with would involve an extraordinary expansion of the pendant appellate jurisdiction doctrine, where no less than, I believe, 8 arguments are urged to be considered by this court as pendant. I don't believe that any of the arguments are appropriately considered as pendant to an FSIA appeal made by the National Bank in this instance. Let's start with the issue raised by OTP, which is the question purportedly of customary international law that they raise under Section 1331. It's notable that MNB did not argue the customary international law argument that OTP is arguing. In other words, MNB hasn't said that Nuremberg is of such questionable validity that it doesn't qualify as a universal norm under SOSA. Now, the basis for international law that MNB has argued and is urging an appeal on is the question of domestic expropriation, which you explored with their counsel. They're not the same issues. There's also a difference because the standard of what's actionable under the FSIA and the standard of what international law violation is actionable under Section 1331 are not synonymous. They are not the same. And to conflate the two, I think, risks a potentially significant amount of confusion. Another issue that is purportedly both collateral and pendant is the issue regarding the statements of interest. We do not believe that the statements of interest overlap in any way with the merits of the National Bank's claims of sovereign immunity, and nor do we believe that these issues are appropriate for a final collateral order appeal. The record on the statement of interest has been nothing but a moving target that has continued up until yesterday, when this court finally accepted the amicus brief filed by the German government. We presume that MKB, the German defendant here, or at least the purportedly German defendant, has been in contact with the German government all along and yet only got this submitted yesterday. The district court certainly didn't have the opportunity to evaluate that. The supplemental statement of interest, which they're talking about, was submitted after the district court's opinion. And the district court did conduct a proceeding. It didn't simply ignore the government's statement of interest. It called a hearing. It brought the government in. It asked the government some questions. The government did not answer those questions. And the judge ruled that at this stage, it is premature. This is not the forum to litigate the merits of the government's claim. In order for this court to sit as a court of law, it needs a record. And that record needs to be developed at the district court. Judge Hamilton, you've noted a number of factual issues which are unresolved, even not known by counsel standing here before you today, that could bear on what the government has to say. And once you properly interpret the foundation agreements, you then have to go through the process of interpreting the value of the foreign policy interest that has been submitted, because it is not the law that the courts reflexively dismiss in favor of a government's expression of foreign policy interest. That is not the law. And I respectfully submit that the prior cases, the Holocaust cases that have deferred, have done so in an entirely different temporal basis. And that temporal basis is those cases were decided in the heat of the negotiation and the beginning of the implementation of those agreements. Today we're sitting here, those agreements are now closed. In other words, what those courts did in deferring, discretionary, by the way, deferring, and we have mandamus over a judge's refusal to apply at this stage of the litigation a discretionary doctrine. What those other courts were doing was deferring to a process that it felt it ought to let the executive carry through. And if you look at the statements of interest filed in those cases, they were very different. They said, you will, if you don't dismiss, you will prevent the foundation agreement from being implemented. Or in the case of the Garamondi case, which involved the insurance laws that California passed regarding the disclosure of insurance accounts, it was temporally immediate. It was, if you don't do this, it will cause immediate harm. What we have here is some generalized expression of the word of the United States. And as we put into our brief, if you put all that in context, it's a fairly low order concern and something that the district court should be allowed to make factual findings on in a proper forum. In other words, we've established that the German government and the Austrian government negotiated for a dismissal, that the U.S. would urge dismissal on the basis of foreign policy interests. In the Foundation Agreement, it was explicitly rejected. It says, in fact, the language of that Annex B says that the foreign policy interests of the United States shall not be an independent basis for dismissal. Shall not be. And if you look at the statement of interest clearly states that dismissal should be based on any valid legal ground. And Annex B of the statement of interest says that the foreign policy interests of the United States are not one of those valid legal grounds. In other words, the German amicus brief is seeking to get through this court what it was unable to negotiate for during the course of the Foundation Agreement. Now, you don't have to take my word for all this. It's in our briefs. But more importantly, these are critical fact questions which need to be developed in a record, in an orderly process, not a process where we had a statement of interest, we had a motion to dismiss, then we had a supplemental statement of interest filed in another case, which, after the motion to dismiss, the government files notice of, and then one of the appellants files notice of it here, and then after all the briefing is closed, we have an amicus brief from the German government. That's not an orderly process. And we would note that each of these defendants had opportunities at the district court to seek proceedings under appropriate rules with appropriate evidence. And for them, it's been all or nothing. They haven't gone to the district court and said, okay, you know what, we want to take another crack at some of these subject matter jurisdiction issues by making a factual 12b1 challenge. Or we want to file summary judgment on some limited issues, and Your Honor, can you set a schedule for that? They haven't done any of that. And the notion of the irreparable harm that would be done for them through the litigation process was pretty clearly rejected in Karami, where this court said in Karami, where the argument was made that the exposure to any aspect of the litigation process is the harm to be committed, that no, it's the freedom to be free from litigation at the earliest reasonable juncture, balancing the interests and needs of the parties. And if you put yourself in the shoes of the litigants, we're plaintiffs. We get a factual or a facial challenge, not a factual challenge, to the complaint for subject matter jurisdiction. We respond to it accordingly, which means we limit our response to the matters raised in the pleading. Now, what we hear is, no, it should really kind of be factual. We have facts we've alleged which are different than the facts in your complaint, and that constitutes an error. Well, we didn't submit any of that because we were following the law. And if you note, in our brief, we have a rather extensive discussion of the distinctions between facial and factual challenges under Rule 12b1 and how we responded accordingly. If you look at the reply briefs that were filed by the four defendants, there's not a mention of the distinction between 12b1 facial and factual challenges. And all of that underscores the need for the district court to conduct an orderly process of fact-finding. So, for example, for the statement of interest, that if the issue does come back to this court, the court can determine whether the district court erred in exercising its discretion, because there's an important separation of powers concern here with regard to the statement of interest. You can't just say, if the government suggests there might be some reason why the government would like the case dismissed, that the courts ought to always grant it. That's not the law. And if this court were to take this issue now and reverse it, that would be exactly the result that would occur. The other issues that are purportedly related to MNB's appeal or not, we even had an argument made by MK or by OTP that because everything was decided in one omnibus opinion, that they're related. They're pushing the boundaries of a doctrine that has been declared all but dead by Judge Easterbrook and McCarter. And on top of that, putting aside the issue that MNB wants you to consider pendently, the other defendants are trying to raise a doctrine that doesn't even exist, which is the notion of pendant party jurisdiction. And the Supreme Court in Swint actually was taking an appeal from the 11th Circuit, where the 11th Circuit had not only granted pendant jurisdiction, but it had done so on behalf of another party, in other words, pendant party. And the Supreme Court clearly said there is no such thing as pendant party jurisdiction. So I would respectfully submit that the pendant arguments made by the private banks invoke a doctrine that doesn't exist. Now, I've sort of already dealt through my discussion of pendant jurisdiction with the mandamus issues, because the mandamus issue significantly relates to the statement of interest. And again, there's no clear right here. Far from it. And because it's a discretionary doctrine, it would be difficult to order a judge to use his discretion to go to a particular result, as opposed to...
Mr. Leon, personal jurisdiction is not a question of discretion. And I hope you'll address that in some detail. In particular, I'd be interested to hear, in essence, your best case for exercising general personal jurisdiction over OTP and MKB here.
Your Honor, I'd be glad to. And, of course, something that wasn't mentioned by OTP or MKB is the fact that we are getting personal jurisdiction here through the use of 4K2 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which allow an aggregation of all the U.S. contacts. Now, let's put that into the lens of non-foreign-based general jurisdiction. Basically, what 4K2 would say is if you take all the contacts in the U.S. and you pretend like they all occur in a single state like Illinois, does that give you general personal jurisdiction? And you have to make a prima facie showing, by the way. That's all that we have to show.
And your best case?
Yeah, my best case is that what you see is a bank. In each instance, you have banks with $90 and $140 million in deposits, which they're regularly conducting transactions with their account holders in the state. They are regularly contracting with businesses in the state.
Could I ask you your best case? You've got a great case for specific jurisdiction on those kinds of contacts, but your best case for general jurisdiction for a foreign entity that has those kinds of relationships?
Well, Your Honor, if you use the purposeful availment standard, I would argue that it's...
How about the essentially at home standard jurisdiction?
Your Honor, I would make the same argument. And I would also suggest that the court might take a look at the ISI case, which deals with – it's the only case, really, that in the Seventh Circuit that's of relevance here that deals with the 4K2 analysis. And the context there are a lot less than what we've alleged here. I believe that there are.
And what you've alleged here is that MKB certification and designation of an agent for services processed and attendance at various business conferences. You've suggested that shows substantial and continuous contacts.
Your Honor, in part, what we've suggested and what we've stated in our briefs is that if you look at each contact individually, you would never find anybody is engaged in general jurisdiction. You have to look at the constellation of contacts, where you have banks which have thousands of depositors with tens of millions of dollars who they're regularly servicing. You have businesses that they're contracting with for hundreds of millions of dollars of business on a regular basis, where they're traveling here on a it's not sporadic. They're coming regularly for these things. They're purchasing things here. They're doing all the things where if you were to take all of our contacts and just look at them and pretend that every one of those things occurred in the state of Illinois, you would say that they're at home in Illinois. They have thousands of depositors, tens of millions of dollars that they're regularly servicing. You have hundreds of millions of dollars of transactions from acquiring IT expertise to servicing credit cards.
Am I correct that ISI dealt with specific jurisdiction?
ISI addressed
having to do with the fraudulent letters that were sent?
Yeah, and let me just pull that up.
Do you think there's any difference between general and specific jurisdiction?
Well, there is, Your Honor. I think that's fairly well established in the law that specific jurisdiction would have to be transactionally related.
So a lot of this, the transactions that you're talking about, the business agreements, those are all very specific.
Well, in other words,
it seems to me you're lumping everything under the general jurisdiction category.
Your Honor, you would. In order to evaluate general jurisdiction, you have to look at all the contacts together. The consents to jurisdiction that they've had in particular contracts where they've consented to the U.S., it would not offend the notion of due process to subject these banks to service of process and
what
process
is your
this court.
Best case? You read what we said in UBID about the GoDaddy's contacts not even being close to general jurisdiction in Illinois. What's your best case for saying that general jurisdiction could be applied here? You don't have anything close to Perkins, the company that was headquartered in Ohio during the war.
Right, right. Your Honor, how I would distinguish...
Give me your best case, please.
Okay. Your Honor, our best case is that if you look at... And I don't have another way to do this.
A decision that supports the exercise of general jurisdiction in this case.
I'm sorry. You meant the best decisional case.
Yes.
Sorry. I would point to ISI. I thought ISI was very helpful in the 4K2 issues.
I thought it was specific jurisdiction since the claims arose out of the relevant contacts.
And I'm just reading it right now, Your Honor, but I believe that it was a general jurisdiction case where the question is whether it would have been unfair to subject them to a Lanham Act claim in light of all of their contacts. There was no argument that the Lanham Act claim at issue in ISI was transactionally related to support specific jurisdiction. Now, that's my recollection of the opinion.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Davis?
Your Honors, I wanted to read specifically to you this morning, as might have been my first statement, the statement of interest from the United States of America in this case. Obviously, I haven't been able to find it now, but I think I've looked at it enough that I can remember one phrase of it. Some measure of justice to the victims of the Holocaust in their remaining lifetimes. Some measure of justice to victims of the Holocaust in their remaining lifetimes. That was the first and statement portion, the preliminary portion of the statement of interest in the United States. That is the primary interest of the United States. Now, the statement of interest that's been filed in this case, and in particular the amicus that was filed yesterday, does not tell you something that's very important. There is no measure of justice that would be made available to the victims of this Holocaust through the political process, through the political branches of this government. The German fund, the Austrian fund, is closed. There is no field here that's being taken by the political branches of this government. They have closed their doors, they have packed their bags, they have gone home in 2006. So, when we talk about the political question and whether or not the political branches of our government have dominated, preempted, occupied this field, it's very important for this court to understand that if there is to be some measure of justice for the victims of the Holocaust in their lifetimes, it will not be offered by the political branches. They have done what they perceive to be their job. They have packed their bags. They have gone home. If there is to be some measure of justice, it must be from this court on this day in this room.
Your group,
and the political question, Doctor.
Your group, however, did not file with the fund, right?
Your Honor, I don't believe our group was eligible for the fund for a number of reasons. The fund was focused on, and certainly our claims were not part of the fund. The German fund was focused on the payment of slave labor, reparations for slave labor. We are not making a claim here for slave labor. We are making claims for, as you know, takings under FSIA, violations of international law under 1331, violations of international law under 1350. Our claims were not covered by the fund. Our claims were never covered by the fund. And that's why Judge Terhagian's one question was, is there something still being made available in the political process for these victims? Because if you're going to defer, if you're not going to find this case to be justiciable, it has to be occupied, it has to be preempted by the political branches. Not only is it not occupied.
That's exactly contrary to the amicus.
That's correct. The amicus, Your Honor, very careful, though, very careful. Could some of our plaintiffs have been eligible? Some of them may well have been in slave labor camps, but that's not their claim in this case. And those are all fact questions as well. Some of them may well have been in those camps, but our claim in this case does not relate to the slave labor camps. One other point I think that's important to make. I don't believe that the United States, the State Department, in its statement of interest, can preclude by entering into an agreement with any foreign country the claims of our non-U.S. plaintiffs. All of our alien tort claims here would not have been precluded, I argue. If you look at Garamendi, for example, which is one of the cases that's cited by the defense, those cases, and the court pointed out, related to claims and those statements of interest can only bind from the State Department U.S. citizens.
That would put the U.S. in a very odd position, wouldn't it, where we're saying our courts are closed to U.S. citizens for these claims, but we're going to litigate the Holocaust on behalf of non-citizens against Hungarian entities here.
Well, I think if you accept the 1331 argument of the defense, that seems to be the argument they're making. In other words, the doors.
I know that, but that also could point them in the direction of state court. But the point that I'm making is that where you seem to be headed is that even if we agree with the defendants on the effect of the German and Austrian foundation agreements.
Right, the State Department agreement.
The State Department, as I call it. Sorry. the executive agreements, whatever. I'm not a diplomat. Never will be. Never will be. But the point is that if we were to agree with the defendants that the statement of interest deserves such deference, that we should dismiss claims of U.S. citizens. You're saying we should still go forward with aliens' claims.
Well, as an aside, yes, of course. I just want to point out to the court that that wouldn't be touching those claims that are being made by the non-U.S. citizens. In other words, our 1350 ATS
claims. And I'm just suggesting that would put the U.S. courts in the very odd position of being, of opening our doors more widely to aliens than we do to our own citizens.
I think that's if the court were to accept that as a bar, which I think, of course, that it is not, because, as I've said, I don't believe any of our plaintiffs. So I don't think the court has to wrestle with that. I think it's the defendants that are trying to put you in the position in their interpretation of 1331 and in their extension of this agreement beyond its bounds, which is an agreement to compensate for slave labor, where that does not cover any of our claims. I would argue that. Of course, as courts also pointed out, the Erste claim has other problems and issues as to whether or not you can enter into a claim or into an agreement in 2000 that would bar claims that immunize you for harms that you've not yet done or crimes that you've not yet committed. So I think that on the political question doctrine, the issue, Your Honors, is whether this field has been preempted. And the defendants are suggesting you are occupied by the defense. And I suggest the defense is suggesting to you that it has, and I suggest that it has not. The political branches no longer are offering anything. Not only they're not occupying it, they have gone. And if we're to get some measure of justice, I think it's ironic when we talk about a measure of justice, because there is nothing here. Even for example, we're offering some measure of justice in our war on terror, because we're offering, for example, Guantanamo, as the courts are familiar. We have military tribunals that are there to give some measure of justice to those individuals who are enemy combatants, among others, as the court's familiar with that whole line of cases. So if this court and in this building we are giving some measure of justice each day to enemy combatants, because there is something being offered to them, there is Guantanamo, there is a forum for enemy combatants, where here there is nothing except what the judicial branch under Article 3 offers. And I suggest to you that this isn't even a close question on the political question doctrine, Your Honor, that this field has not been preempted. And the mild, so to speak, efforts being made by the State Department here is nothing more than an attempt to honor their word. They said they would come in and they would advise the courts of these settlements. They're offering no legal grounds, because there isn't. If there were a political question doctrine, an amicus would have been filed by our State Department saying, you need to step out because the political question doctrine demands that you do. Of course it doesn't, because this field has not been preempted. Your Honors, I want to, if I may move on to another point. I'm glad to address this further, but I think we've addressed it in our briefs, and I think that we said the agreement doesn't touch our claims. It doesn't touch half of our claimants. The doors have been closed, unlike all the other Holocaust cases where there's been a finding that the political branch has preempted it. The political branch is not preempting this. I would like to address briefly the idea that a sovereign can do whatever it wishes to its own people. And on that, there are several things that the court, I think, needs to understand. Things strike you in the course of a case like this where you're reading briefs and pleadings. One phrase struck me very much, and I don't know if it was Ersta or OTP. This was not genocide in the usual sense. Not genocide in the usual sense. And it came to me, finally, I think, to understand that they're right. This was genocide without borders. This was not a genocide committed within the borders of a country. And I suggest, for example, you look at our complaint in the Mack case. And I believe it's paragraph 71, I stand corrected. We define the Greater Hungary, Your Honor. It's a very important concept, the Greater Hungary, Your Honors. The Greater Hungary consisted of not only Hungary, Trianon-Hungary under the 1991 treaty, but we defined it in our complaint as also including, as of 1940, occupied territories of Yugoslavia, of Czechoslovakia, and of the Ukraine. So, and we also allege, I believe if you look at paragraphs 95, that what happened here could not have happened, and I think the best phrase is a phrase that we use in our work in The Hague, joint criminal enterprise. This could not have been done by the Hungarian Railroad and the Hungarian banks alone. Obviously, it was done with the assistance of the Nazis. So we're not talking here about a sovereign acting exclusively on its own, addressing only its own people. This involved victims, including victims of the Greater Hungary. This involved a joint criminal enterprise that could not have been accomplished without the incredible effort being made, for example, by the railroad, including the banks, to transport 500,000 people from Budapest and other areas to Auschwitz during heavy Allied bombing, 1944, March to July of 1944, Normandy, heavy bombing each day. This could not have been accomplished without a concerted joint effort. This was not the effort of an individual sovereign. To further make that point, we look at the current Hungarian constitution, Your Honors, which went into effect on January 1st of this year. In the constitution itself, which is in our brief, the statement appears, we hold that the self-determination of our state lost on 19 March 1944 was restored on 2 May 1990 with the formation of our first freely elected representative body. That is the day we consider to be the beginning of a new democracy and constitutional order for our country. I think it's very difficult for the defendants to come in and say that they're entitled to this concept of domestic taking and to be immune when they themselves, in their own when the government of Hungary itself has taken the position that we were not sovereign from 19 March 1944 until 1990. It also addresses, interestingly enough, the statute of limitations in their preface. And that is, in this preface, we declare that no statutory limitation applies to the inhuman crimes committed against the Hungarian nation and its people under the National Socialist and Communist dictatorships. I draw your Court's attention to those two points.
That point, Mr. Pavich, seems to suggest that Hungarian law is moving in your direction. You obviously face many obstacles under the United States law in pursuing these claims. Why not go to Hungary?
Well, Your Honor, I think we have...
Under the new laws.
Well, the new laws have not yet been established. In fact, Your Honor, this Constitution, and this creates a number of fact questions, but it's well known that a concern, not only throughout Europe now, that Hungary is moving in an anti-Semitic direction, that this Constitution itself...
Do you want us to rely on Hungarian law or not?
I think that the court should be aware of the inconsistency between taking the position here, and we're not only relying on the Constitution, but the inconsistency of the defendants to, on the one hand, say that this is nothing more than a domestic taking involving a sovereign against its own people, when there seems to be some question about that, not only based on what I've brought up earlier, but on the Constitution itself. The Constitution has, in fact, been criticized because, as we get further into the Constitution, these would be fact questions that we may have to develop a trial on a doctrine of forum nonconvenience, and that is it has been criticized for eroding the judicial branch of the Hungarian government in favor of the political branches in a climate which has become increasingly anti-Semitic in the past 2 years. So these are fact questions, Your Honor, that we may well have to get into later in terms of the details of the foreign nonconvenience argument, but there's some very, very serious issues that have been raised relating to whether or not Hungary can provide a proper forum. Its courts do not, for example, they require that the plaintiffs pay costs, substantial costs, before you can even, under the old constitution, I'm not familiar with the details of this one, in order to pursue a claim. Class actions, et cetera, may not be available there, but there are certainly some questions that we could raise and develop down below.
Let me ask you, Mr. Pavich, on this question of domestic takings that the defense has argued, are you asking us to disagree with the 11th Circuit in Fogade, the 9th Circuit in Altman, the 5th Circuit in DeSanchez, the 9th Circuit in Seiderman, or are you suggesting you want to distinguish those cases?
Well, I've already, I think, distinguished them because this is not a domestic taking, number one. I think also that the law here, and Sosa makes, I think it's clear, for example, under the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, there is no exception for domestic taking. Sosa's written into the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. It does not, in fact, Your Honor, the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act itself was created as a reaction to Sabatino, the Sabatino case.
I'm sorry, what part of Sosa addresses that?
Addresses the domestic taking?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Sosa does not, Your Honor. It does not.
Perhaps I misunderstood.
No, Sosa does not. No. We're distinguishing, Your Honor, I think, the cases on domestic taking, as I have distinguished. I think, however, the principle that a nation cannot, with impunity, act against, assuming that is acting against only its own citizens, if it is violating customary international law, and that is the basis of, for example, our humanitarian interventions that have gone on in Libya, in Kosovo, and that we are continuing to intervene in various countries. But yes, I also would bring into question, as we have, whether or not our people, our victims, would be considered citizens under that provision.
The rule is written in terms of nationals. But let me ask, under your theory, let me just ask you the hypotheticals. Suppose Spain or Belgium or Switzerland decided to entertain claims by descendants of Native Americans for the expropriation of their land in the United States, or the expropriation of property of Japanese-American citizens during World War II. Would that be appropriate under international law as you view it?
Well, international law, as the court is aware, would allow claims to be made under a very narrow band of facts, wherein the taking or the wrong would have to be considered universally as an enemy of mankind, so to speak. Whether it's to my knowledge, the only areas that have been identified that would allow such a judicial proceeding would be piracy, torture, genocide, crimes against humanity. That very narrow band is what
expropriation of property. That's what you're arguing here.
This was expropriation of property that was being done in a genocidal context. It was being done
in
order to.
That's a term that has been used with respect to our treatment of Native Americans.
That's correct. I mean, I don't know enough, Your Honor,
about. If we agree with this theory, what would the argument be if the United States government is sued, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Department of Interior, U.S. government is sued in another country for expropriation of property?
If the United States was sued because it was part of a genocidal campaign to destroy an identifiable group in whole or in part, and no remedy was available in the United States, our courts did not make a remedy available, which I think would not be the case because we would make such a remedy theoretically available.
Is that what would be the decisive issue? Just the availability of a remedy?
Well, I think there would be two issues. First, whether or not the claim could be pursued. But, yes, under that theory, if we have committed a crime that is universally condemned, intentionally so done, and in order to destroy a group in whole or in part, that, yes, I believe a cause of action could be maintained, and there was no remedy or a forum made available in the home forum, then, yes, in fact, as the court probably is aware, there are courts in Spain, in Belgium, that have had such cases brought and had to struggle with those cases. So I believe that is not hypothetical. I believe it's already out there. The point is to, obviously, don't commit genocide. If you do, then you're subject to, it is a crime that is universally condemned, and therefore, there is no safe haven. There should be no safe haven for those who commit genocide, even if they are private corporations. And I know where this court stands on that issue. There should be no safe haven. That's our position, Your Honor. Yes.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have 1 minute for rebuttal, again, for MNB Bank, who's asserting its sovereign immunity. Two quick points. One, there was no mention by Mr. Pavich of the 1947 treaty, which is indeed the executive branch's statement with regard to resolving claims concerning Hungarian reparations, as to which under Article 40 it provides the executive branch to embark in a dialogue with the Hungarian executives regarding these issues, and that treaty is still in force and in effect. And again, we've heard nary a mention of that. As to the domestic takings principles, the only thing I do want to raise in response to Your Honor's earlier question about the development of CIL, I do want to remind the Court, as I should have earlier, that the domestic taking rules and the international rules in place at the time of the acts is what controls. And it may be that international law and customary international law develops at some point to allow a remedy down the road. But in 1944, according even to Professor D'Amato, who sits on the plaintiff's table, that the rule of law at that time strictly enforced the domestic taking rule and is the same rule that's been applied in cases that have been mentioned by the Court. And my time is up.
Do you agree, counsel, that the German Foundation, or is that the name of it, the German Foundation, is no longer in existence or no longer effective?
Your Honor, I'll defer that question to the parties who are members of that. I'm MNB, not the others. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Charles Rothfeld for MKB Bank. I'll make two quick points, if I can, one relating to the German Foundation. It is closed in the sense that it's not taking additional claims at this point, but it was the clear policy of the United States that all claims that could have been brought should have been brought when it was open, and that it should have been and was the exclusive remedy for claims relating to German companies from the Nazi era.
Are they limited to slave labor claims?
And they absolutely were not, Your Honor. It is quite clear that these claims would have been covered, and I will refer the Court to the Supplemental Joint Appendix at pages 86, 102-03, 107, and 110, which indicate that claims involving property and banking assets were clearly covered by the agreement. I should add, there is no doubt, in addition, that MKB qualifies as a German company for purposes of the foundation, as both the United States and Germany have informed the district court and this court. And so it is absolutely clear that the foundation is covered here. And just to clarify what we're saying about the foundation agreement and the U.S. statement of interest, it is not that they are preemptive or occupy the field. It is that they should demonstrate the compelling U.S. interest in immediate resolution of these claims on any valid legal ground. And we've identified two valid legal grounds this morning, personal jurisdiction and the statute of limitations. And if I can just take one more second to answer one of Judge Hamilton's questions referring on the leading cases, the principal cases on which we rely on jurisdiction. There are a number of cases that we think are controlling on our side. I'll refer to Judge Hamilton's opinion for the Court in UBID, in which the contacts with the jurisdiction were vastly more extensive than they are in this case. They were sufficient for specific jurisdiction, but not for general jurisdiction, which is all that is alleged and is at issue here. UBID, we think, is controlling and requires dismissal of this case. Therefore, we urge the Court to grant the writ of mandamus because there is irreparable injury that's being caused by the district court's decision. Entitlement to relief is clear, and the writ should issue. There are no further questions.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
May it please the Court, with respect to Judge Hamilton's last question to Mr. Pavich, the largest expropriation of property in human history is probably the expropriation of the property of the American Indians by the United States of America in the 19th century. And generally, I mean, you can argue that that wasn't a genocide, but many people do argue that it is a genocide. In fact, it's referred to in footnote 5 of our reply brief about genocide of the United States in Mr. Kiernan's book, a book brought to the Court's attention originally by the plaintiffs. Two minor points, Your Honor. Greenwell, decided by this Court in 2001 after Swint, was a case where there was pendant party appellate jurisdiction. So I think pendant party appellate jurisdiction is accepted in this Court. With respect to the development of customary international law brought up by more than one judge, Judge Williams, I think, and Judge Hamilton, developments of CIL, and there are developments with respect to domestic takings, then there's no doubt about that. But if you're looking at what's happening in 1944, the original taking has to meet Sosa's standard in 1944, and afterwards has to meet the Sosa standard if you're going to go after the private banks. And I think that the Chessville does not create a Sosa standard. the SOSA standard is created, is established by Dreyfus, which is a 1976 case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Candle.
Very quickly, Your Honor. First, to return to a question of Judge Hamilton, I've confirmed during this interim it was a stock transaction, and the corporation was still in existence, and consequently, it should be a defendant. If the plaintiffs want to pursue the claims against that company, they chose to instead sue Erste. Addressing a couple of other questions, first, it is simply untrue that the issue of political question is not covered by the provisions of the legal grounds that are permitted under the statement of interest. If I can respectfully refer the court to page SJA 156 of the documents, there the statement of interest outlines what the valid bases would be of legal defenses. The very second one listed is justiciability. Justiciability is obviously one that encompasses political questions. In answer to another question, the foreign policy of the United States is not dependent on whether or not the particular plaintiffs are U.S. citizens or are foreign citizens. The foreign policy of the United States, as exemplified in the statement of interest, is designed to protect the relations between the United States and foreign countries, including Austria and Germany, regardless of who the claimants are. The final point I wanted to make is counsel made the statement that there was an opportunity that the court conducted a hearing on issues relating to the coverage of the statement of interest. The fact is that what he is referring to as a hearing was an uncontested hearing on his motion for leave to respond to a statement of interest. The judge asked a member of the Justice Department some questions. She was ill-prepared for them. She didn't know the answers. And Erste addressed every single one of the questions in the April 7 transcript in its reply brief. So the court had all that information long before it made its decision. And incidentally, the statements in the supplemental statement of interest are directly taken from what Erste said in his reply brief. Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.